We implemented many ITIL processes.
The world's most practiced method for project management.
ITIL has been a catalyst in my career.
Hundreds of thousands of people with a Prince 2 qualification.
I've seen ITIL help organizations be more successful.
The Axelos Podcast, bringing best practice directly to you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Axelos Global Best Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Akshay Anand. And joining me today is an extraordinarily creative professional, Reina Jhaveri. I'll get to introducing Reina in a bit, but I just wanted to remind everyone that this is part of a series that we're doing highlighting creative professionals and their creative processes, and then talking to IT and IT service management experts about how we can observe similar creative patterns in our own organizations, in our own teams, or indeed how we might think about coaching such creativity, mentoring such creativity within our teams. So joining me today, as I said, is Reina Jhaveri, who's based out of New York, I believe.
Boston.
Oh, Boston. I'm sorry. It's all East Coast. It's all across the pond for me. She joins us. I shouldn't be so glib. My wife spent a lot of time in Boston. It's a lovely place. Been there many, many times. Reina, in her own words, is a quantum monkey, a money punk, a blacklight oracle, and a metaphysician of joy. And I'm sure she's going to explain all of those words to us very shortly. She's also a punk musician, which I find very intriguing. She's also a stand-up comic, a published writer, and a TV chef on a multi-Emmy-winning cooking show, which, for those of you who want to go to YouTube and look up some episodes, it's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Television. So, Reina, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Absolutely, Akshay. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to shaking some things up, stirring the pot, as it were.
Well, let's start with that introduction, because, you know, in terms of stirring things up, I've never seen an introduction like that before. Quantum money punk, blacklight oracle, and metaphysician of joy. Just seeing those words brings a smile to my face. But why don't you explain what that means for us plebs?
I like to have fun with everything I do, Akshay. And it starts with something as simple as my bio. I change it a lot, right? And this really goes to speak to the fact that I don't identify closely with any sort of label or title, right? This is one of the cornerstones of creativity. I'm essentially a coach of creativity and intuition. This is my today. This is what it's coming out as today, right? But at the base of it, I coach very high level people who are especially very tuned in to their thoughts and their mind and mental processes, who have learned or been taught to override their intuition and their deep creative wisdom, which all of us, by the way, are born with. Even people who say, I don't have it and I'm not a creative person, these are lies. So the oracle part of me is a truth teller. I say what I see, and I see a lot of depth, right? I have this ability in Hindi or in Sanskrit, this is called Siddhi. And my grandmother pointed this out to me when I was very young, because I came to her saying, I see certain things in people that they're not able to see, right? I experience it in a physical way in my body. I'm a super empath in this sense. And as a kid, I was taught not to tell the truth. One of the most powerful lessons I got was when I was very young, and I spoke, I said that I saw adults lying to each other, right? And I saw what the game was. Somebody wanted something from somebody else. And they were very, right, very fluid and silky with their words. But they were telling a story about a time that I was present at, and they were completely changing the details because they wanted to impress this other person. Right now, I must have been 8 or 10 years old at this point. So I wasn't very old, but I was old enough to know. And I remember say something, and I got corrected immediately, like, don't interfere. And this moment was a really like a moment to me, I think, that crystallized the fact that, does it mean we have to lie to be adults? Does being grown up mean we have to keep the truth back? We can't be ourselves. We have to lie to get things. And I remember in this moment feeling like, I don't want to grow up like this. I refuse. Mm-hmm. But I internalized a lot of that learning, right? I didn't have anybody around me to to speak about this with. So I kept telling the truth inside me, but it started building and building and building till much later in adulthood. It literally, like, I had several years where it was very explosive truth telling, because all the years I'd taken on everybody else's lies, internalized, I could see this happening. And I remember going to my grandmother saying, I can see things in people, not like I see dead people, but literally I can, right. I can feel things in people. And I would also have it, the metaphysical part is like, I was able, sometimes I would foresee things or see things that were happening in other places. And I'm, my formal education is in neurobiology. So just to be clear,
sure,
this was a very difficult integration I had to do with myself, right? That I had these spiritual, emotional, creative, metaphysical sides, we all do, and that I had these very grounded 3D reality kind of, like, I was trained as a scientist. I was pre-med, trained as a scientist. So how do we integrate those two, right? So I was very fractured for most of my life. And so what I do now is like extreme integration for people who are like head and heart and they're in conflict. Right. And so I work actually with a lot of people in tech, a lot of people in like design and engineering who also have, right, a creative side that has been squashed or repressed. And they're starting to bump up against the edges of that. They feel like the rules are constricting them. They're not allowed to be completely free.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you say that. I'm grateful you say that. I mean, my original thinking when I designed this mini series of podcasts was that, you know, creativity is a human trait. It's not necessarily only something that software developers show. It's not only something that design professionals show. You can see creativity everywhere across your organization. It may manifest in different ways. And I think it's a bit perhaps egotistical for somebody to say, that's not creative. Well, to that person who's doing something, it might be creative. And, you know, who are we to judge other people's actions, as it were? Reina, let's talk a little bit about your career as a chef, not just your time on the TV show, but even before that, what were your influences that inspired you to take up cooking professionally? And then what made you want to go to television as a medium to cook in?
A lot of this, Akshay, was very fortuitous, and some of it was kind of prescient. I saw some of this happening before it happened. But as a kid, I come from a family of gourmands. My grand aunt, as it were, my god aunt, was the Julia Child of India, Tarla Dalal. She wrote some of the earliest cookbooks. This is knowledge that used to be just passed down orally, that was then crystallized into books. My grandfather was her advisor, and so she would come to him and he would say, no, a pinch less of salt and like a shake more of this, or how about you move it up like this. And so I was around this all the time. I'd wake up extra early on the weekends and go with my grandfather to like the old school farmers markets. This was my most exciting thing. There's something very physical about cooking, right? It's very, you have to be very present in cooking.
That's true.
And
a thousand burnt dinners of mine say that's very true. Yeah,
I have a lot of failure stories. I'm self-taught, and this was the most interesting part of it for me, right? It's something I could do all the time. I started cooking when I was probably 5 or 7 years old. There's a story of me. I was getting very adamant about cooking French style fluffy omelets, and my mom had to, you know, give me a stool to reach the stove because I couldn't even reach the stove. But I get into something, right, when something grabs our interest, I'll do it over and over. I get completely absorbed by it. And this is part of the creative process. I allow myself to get completely absorbed and present with it. And this actually accelerates the learning tremendously, tremendously. And then the truth teller in me, right, I have an entertainer truth teller personality. So from a very young age, I was also told, like, you should be on television hosting a TV show or hosting this or that or the other. So those two things somehow combined in my mind. And many, many years later, I moved to the US, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago now. And I was told, hey, you always said you wanted to do a TV show. There's a local TV station down the street. Every town here has this kind of government run, like a Wayne's World kind of a channel.
Sure.
Right. It's kind of virtually free, and the resources are there, and you just go and, like, they need content and you need the equipment, right? So it's a nice mutual process. So that's how it started. And I just said, I'm going to make a show. I don't know how, but the restrictions that were given to me by the station, right? There was no kitchen there. So I had a news desk and it was a live stream. So it was like, how do I make a food show with no food and no kitchen? So this is something I want to offer to all your listeners, that restrictions, as a creative person, restrictions is my superpower, because it forces me to think very creatively and work within, right, the constraints of what I've been given. You will find, even your people will find, if you give them complete free rein, sometimes for people like me, that can be overwhelming. So working within the restrictions allowed me to make this show on my own. And I committed every week I would go and make this live show. And that ended up becoming a show reel to a few years later when I was in an interview situation with this new media company for a marketing position. I was doing marketing and communications at the time. And they happened to be making this TV show. It was not known to me at that time. But this is as known to the universe. You keep saying, oh, yeah, and I have this show. Oh, yeah, and I have this show. They're like, you have a show? Can you send us links? And I had links to the dinky TV show that I made locally, but that became my show reel. It was essentially a free show reel that I made my terms. And that got me into this show, you know, riding the shoulders of giants. These are amazing professionals that have been doing this for years and years. They've won multiple Emmys. And now I'm in the fourth season of the show and we're in the works with the season five. And every single year we've got an Emmy for the show. So I get to cook on TV and there's a whole crew, right, that researches the recipes and does all the testing and writes it up and stuff. So each of us bring our own talent on there. So it's not me doing everything from start to finish. I'm a really good presenter and I have a certain kind of energy that people really relate to, right? And an infectious personality.
It's a huge team.
This is a big, right? This is like five cameras and dollies and close-ups and there's a hair and makeup lady. And I was like so excited to hear hair and makeup. So I know some of your, you know, if your questions, some of the questions are like, whether, you know, how I decide from start to finish, none of this happens in a vacuum.
Yeah? Right.
This is a big team effort. I get to do what I'm best at and everybody else brings, right? Everybody on there is like the best at what they do.
Right.
And that's how it works.
That's a brilliant environment to be in. Absolutely. So if you were to reflect back then on your career as a professional chef, would you be able to point to something, not necessarily a singular experience, but would you be able to point to something to say, you know, this is the best thing about being a professional chef and equally, this is the worst thing about being a professional chef?
Very easy answer. You get to be completely you.
You know, a lot of people would kill for a job like that.
So there, a lot of people would, and then this is also what I coach around. I help people find their zone of genius where they can show up completely and completely aligned as themselves and have to, so it feels effortless because it's what you do all the time anyways, but kind of on speed, right? You get to amp up your inside personality by dropping all the external layers of ways you're told to, you know, be like this and don't be like that, say this and don't say that, show up like this, but not like that. So, you know, shame and fear and all these things, which many of us wear multiple masks of this, right? But my success personally and professionally has come from, and all the creative things I do have come from learning how to take off these masks, right? Like learning that how I am in this moment is completely enough and then some. Like we all have this divine magic inside us. And my goal really, right, when I show up on television as well, it activates people in a certain people are very responsive. Like I get every week, I get people just reaching out, random people reaching out saying, there's something about your energy, right? There's something about your voice. And everyone does this for other people in certain ways. Right. And this is really my ultimate goal. And it's frightening, it's terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. This is why best and worst, right? We're so afraid of being fully ourselves. What if we get ostracized from the tribe? Sure. What if we get judged by our family and friends? What if we outgrow our teachers and mentors and supervisors, right? What happens then? So these are very like dark feelings that exist in all of us. But I'm role modeling it for myself because that's how I grow. And I'm role modeling for anyone who needs to see it. And the same, like trusting that the creative source is the same. So I can move effortlessly between being a musician, being a television chef, being a comic, being a writer, like all those things come from the same source. So when you are connected to that source, shifting mediums, that's the surface level of what you see.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
Shape-shifting becomes very easy when you're tapped into that deep creative source.
Sure. So you mentioned some of the other people on the show, for example, help in testing recipes or doing the research and show and so on. I'm not sure how involved you are in that, but what is the starting point to actually conceptualizing that final dish, that final product? Is it, for example, you're starting with, let's say, ingredients you want to showcase, or you want to highlight a particular technique, whether that's a technique to preparing the ingredients or cooking the ingredients or something, or is it that, you know, you want to start with the experience of consuming that dish? And what I mean by that is, you know, some of the best dining experiences I've had are where it's on two ends of a spectrum. It's either a dish that looks like, you know, the end product of a dog's dinner, but it tastes absolutely amazing. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have a dish that, you know, not only tastes good, but also smells good, looks good. You know, it feels good in your mouth. There may be an audible component, like, you know, that you savor the crunch or whatever it might be, or the sizzle, you know. So there's even an element of hearing the dish. But when you're conceptualizing dishes for the show, where do you start? Do you generally start in the same place and work a different path outwards, or do you just start according to a theme or something like that?
So it's a little of all of those things, Akshay. I'm not involved in every step of the way from the ground up. That's why we have this big team. But I can definitely speak to, like, even in my own personal cooking, right? For me, it's like, what sparks your imagination? What gives you a feeling of expansion? Like, are your knowledge is going to expand? Your repertoire is going to expand? You described very beautifully, like, the sensory hits that happen on all levels, right? Where can I take what I know to the next level? And the show as well, it is really designed to not be so foreign or so exotic that it becomes unreachable for our viewers. But it is really a show, in my view, designed for expansion, right? So take what you know and expand that and then twist it up a little bit. Like, oh, what happens if you, right, you make, I don't know, this is not anything that's on the show, but like something traditional American, like meatloaf or, I don't know, spaghetti. But then we add a little twist, like, how do the Italians do it? Or how might a technique from traditional Chinese cooking help us make this traditional dish, like this traditional American dish, better? Or how might a different tool from another culture, right, an approach from a different culture? So it's not fusion, it is really expansion. Take what you know and then build on that, and then find the edges and borders of that and twist that a little bit, but not so much that it's uncomfortable, just enough to push you to the next level, right? So then you can then you can integrate it into what you know, and then you can continue from there. So that's really the process of this particular show, as well as my own cooking in my own personal life.
Fair point. So when you're cooking on the show or preparing to cook on the show, and as you mentioned, you want to be able to create dishes that your viewers can also try out at home. Do you find that the tools that you use make for a better dish, a better experience, or is it the inherent creativity that shines through, even if you have bad gear?
What is that? Is it a bad carpenter blames his tools?
Well, not quite that. I mean, I asked in an earlier episode in the series, I asked a photographer whether he would prefer to work with someone who had, you know, the top end equipment, the top end cameras, lenses, the best software, etc., or whether he would prefer to work with someone who creatively, compositionally was superior, but maybe did not have the right gear or the best gear. And his was an interesting answer, and that's why I'm posing the same question to you. Would you know, not just the team you have around you, but also for the home viewers who are trying to recreate that dish in their kitchens? Do you believe that certain types of gear or quality of that kitchen equipment is a must? Or do you think that, you know, no matter how bad your pots and pans and spatulas might be, if you're inherently creative, you will figure it out? Where on that spectrum would you land?
Actually, for me, this is like such a no-brainer. It's always the latter. It's all, your creativity can trump everything, everything. And your creativity will then push you to finding the next level of quality tool that you need, right? Maybe you borrow it from a friend. Maybe you find a way around it. I believe that anyone can cook for themselves with, like, I've done this with a 20 rupee knife from the streets of India and nothing else, right? Literally nothing else. I have cooked in deserts. I have cooked in abandoned hotel bathrooms. I can't even tell you. I've cooked in vans, right? The most fun thing is actually for the creative mind is to find a way out. This is where the punk musician in me comes out too. It's like, we're obsessed with using what we have. And then we find we have lots more than we think. And I find that there's a lot of people with, right, the access and resources to get all the fancy equipment. And let me tell you how much dusty equipment I've seen, brand new dusty equipment sitting in a pantry, right? This is a little bit like an ego fluffing thing. It's like, oh, I have this like fancy, I'm going to caramelize the top of a creme brulee one day. It's this super mini thing I found in a fancy store, never used. So if the equipment is not serving the creative artist, then it is useless, no matter how good it is.
That's a very interesting answer. When I asked the photographer this, his response actually fell in the middle. And if you were to ask me the same question, I think I'd fall in the middle as well. I mean, yes, you need that creativity, and sometimes placing those constraints will result in highly creative solutions. Having said that, I also believe that you need some basics, right? Whether that's in photography or in cooking, like I could replace the grater I have and chop carrots really, really finely. But that's going to take more time, more effort, etc. So, you know, there's a trade-off. I'd rather go out and buy a good grater so that I can get to the end result, the end outcome, quicker and it's something that I think will be used quite often. I do agree with you, though. You know, my wife regularly scolds me for buying equipment that I use once or twice and then not at all. So I agree with that. I mean, I think that's the other end of the spectrum. But I do believe that there are some basic pieces of equipment that any home cook should have.
I like a good knife. Let me tell you, I have been to people's homes where I brought my own knife because I know they have very dull knives and it will drive me crazy. So I'm the first to say, just give me one sharp knife and I'm good. Right? Sure. And you know what, but I'll develop the skill on the one tool. Like, so I think it's like a minimalist approach. I want one really good tool versus like a bunch of tools that I think I need and they're top end, but I'm not going to use. So I think in a way, it's also, I fall in the middle in the sense of, I don't want us to think that just by getting a bunch of equipment that's top end that we're not going to use and we don't understand what it's there doing for us, because some part of you thinks that you needed that. So need is a very slippery slope. So that's why I say, if you strip it all back and you start from scratch, then find out what you truly can do without, and then you start pushing, right? Okay, I'm tired of grating these carrots. So I grate them every freaking day with this grater. I'm going to get a different one, right? So then you move up.
Right. You know, what you're describing really does remind me of the chef Alton Brown, whom I'm a big fan of, also a TV chef for those listeners who are not familiar with him. Again, go to YouTube. There are plenty of clips up there. But I got into cooking back when I was living in the States. And at the time, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, introduced me to the Food Network. And she loved lots of different shows, but for whatever reason, Alton Brown, with his crazy props and puppetry and his scientific approach to cooking, was appealed to that sort of ex-engineer in me. But he also has this hatred for unitaskers, what he calls unitaskers. So tools that can do just one thing and only one thing. Instead of that, try to figure out how you can do the same thing using a different tool, so that one tool can serve many, many purposes. And that's something that I think has definitely influenced my creativity. And we see that a lot in our workplaces as well. Mm-hmm. I'd like to end with a quick question before we wrap things up. Cooking for television is obviously very different to cooking from home. I mean, you're cooking essentially for yourself. You're cooking to create something that looks good, that looks appealing, to encourage your viewers to try that for themselves. So in that sort of an environment, what does feedback look like to you as a chef? I mean, do you essentially call people, I mean, sort of kind of literally off the streets to sort of say, try this dish, tell us what you think about it? Or do you give it to cast and crew members and say, what do you think about it? But how do you sort of break that, the sort of self-affirmation loop, if you will, if you're essentially cooking for yourself or cooking for crew? How do you get feedback on things that you're trying out?
That's a really great question for television, especially the first year that we recorded this. We did it with a live audience present, but that was more for their reactions while they were watching the show being filmed. Feedback is a slippery slope because everyone wants to give their opinion. Whose opinion do you solicit? Whose opinion do you listen to? Right? And are you then just trying to please a billion different people and you end up with a very compromised product? So for us, it's kind of a mix of trusting our expertise. We have reached this level for a reason, right? And we get other experts in the room, and the cast and crew will try stuff before actually filming. And these go through rigorous testing processes, from selection to execution to like simplification to how it's actually written out to shooting the video, what is going to make the most sense for the viewer. So it's a combination of expertise, trusting your expertise, and then getting feedback from like a limited selected number of people. Because at the end of the day, if you're the leader of the opinion, right? If you are outsourcing your expertise to the masses, then you are not the leader anymore.
Interesting.
Right. Okay. So we take ownership, really, is what I think it is. It is an ownership of, we're going to try this out. And not everything's going to land with everybody, right? Like Alton Brown spoke to you in a certain way, and there's other chefs out there who speak to other people in different ways. So the market is always going to be changing. And if you're trying to please, you know, everybody, you please nobody. So we have become, it's kind of this middle ground of like trusting your expertise, trusting your authority, trusting the journey you've been on since doing it for years and years, decades, right? There's something that has a lot of weight. Sure. And then certain people who we think are reflective of our audience, or we have a sense of that, may give some feedback, and we'll take it into account to a level. And if it becomes unmanageable, then, right, sometimes we scrap a lot. There's a lot of recipes that get scrapped. Like this,
of course, yeah.
At the end of the day, it just doesn't make sense. Like it doesn't work out the way we want. So right. We'll scrap things too. But yeah, I love that question though. Thanks for asking that.
Oh, my pleasure. Let's wrap it up here. Reina, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and your experience with our audience. And I can't wait to share this recording with our IT and IT service management professionals for the second half of this episode and see what they think about reflecting on some of what you've said. Are there any social media platforms or channels that you would suggest our audience checks out if they want to follow you and follow your work?
Sure. I think, I mean, these days I'm pretty active on Instagram, and my handle is at the.punkmonk. So that's the.punkmonk. And I do a lot of digital creativity there. Also very intuitive hits of things. So I make things within seconds, whatever comes, with no planning. So it's kind of fun to watch. And I'm going to be speaking more on that platform. So that's probably the best way to find me. And I really want to thank you for having me on this show, Akshay. It's been a pleasure.
No, like I said, thank you. We couldn't have done it without you. And of course, thanks to Harry for staying on to record this. For those of you who don't know, Harry's also a fairly creative professional, and I hope to record him one day. He does a lot of not just editing and recording work, but he's also a nifty cameraman, if I remember correctly as well. So Harry, thanks for staying on during this conversation as well. Hi everyone, Akshay here. As you know, we like to feature what we call shoutouts as part of every podcast episode. And for this episode, we bring some words of advice from Vasilis Sandros, someone I've been working with for the past several months. Vasilis is currently the marketing manager over at PeopleCert. And in working with him over the past several months, as I said, I found him to be a remarkable individual, full of some amazing stories, which I've asked him to share with all of you today. So without further ado, let's hand it off to Vasilis.
Hi, I'm Vasilis Sandros, and I'm a product marketing manager for business and IT qualification in PeopleCert. And predominant place in my product portfolio has ITIL, of course. Academically, I started by studying applied informatics, which is a school where IT courses are combined with management, marketing, and finance. And then I continued my studies with my first master's in information systems, such as ERPs, CRMs, decision-making systems, etc. And later on, I did my second master's in HSC Paris in marketing with a specialization in digital marketing. Now, professionally, I've changed different countries, industries, and roles so far in my career. I started working in Greece as a sales rep first, and later on as a marketing manager in the manufacturing industry. And then I moved to the Netherlands, where I worked as a digital technology specialist in the diagnostics industry. And now I am, as I said, product marketing manager in PeopleCert in the educational learning industry. Being a product marketing manager means that you have the overall responsibility of a product or a portfolio of products, from setting up market plans, yearly commercial strategies, marketing activities such as events, campaigns, launches, competition analysis, of course. And you should also make sure that this plan is being executed successfully by collaborating with many internal and external stakeholders, and primarily, of course, with sales to achieve your product goals as they were set from the beginning. Now, being responsible for an established product like ITIL is a double-edged sword, I would say, meaning that you manage a well-known and very well-appreciated product worldwide, which should also be reflected somehow in your results. The expectations, of course, are completely different than having a new product and building it from scratch. I don't say if it's more or less difficult, it's different. And especially when we, and I'm saying we because Axelos knows this very well, we are trying to keep this ITIL certification relevant and up to date according to the latest evolutions of the IT industry. And at the same time, we are also trying to make it more appealing and valuable for new market segments and new job roles. Keeping this fine balance between those two aspects is always demanding. I think that one of the projects that I'm very proud of is a new CRM implementation that we did back in 2016, 2017 in the company that I was working for. I was part of the leading project team for almost 20 months. Starting from the beginning, from the vendor selection process, installation, customization afterwards, adaptation of the existing processes to the system or the other way around, user adoption and training till the commercial, let's say, reporting in the end. It was a very complete and a very important project that I effectively contributed, and that's why I'm proud of. Now, in terms of challenges, you know, every change is a challenge on its own. And I told you so far I had some. The fact that you have to adjust to different environments, cultures, different habits is always a challenge. Now, in general, there are various types of challenges along the way, some of them professional, some of them personal. According to my opinion, personal challenges are the most difficult ones to overcome. And I remember in the past, I had one to face while being abroad, and I had to return back to my country of origin. I decided to put first things first, if I can say so, which means that family had a priority over professional aspirations. And I always kept in mind what one of my professors in the university used to say, that our lives are not like sprints or marathons. This is an analogy that we use quite often, that we start from point A and we go to point B by following a specific path. It's more like sailing, which means that it starts from point A till point B, which is our goal, our aspiration, let's say. But in the meantime, there is no path defined. I mean, there will be many zigzags, there will be many turnarounds, there will be many difficulties. But because of all these headwinds and tailwinds that we all see, the most important thing is to keep your goals and values as a compass and keep on going. You know, they say that by the time they ask you for advice, it means that you are somehow old, and hopefully this is not the intention here. Now, for someone at the beginning of his or her career, I would advise to stick to a good mentor or a good team and value this more than just a big corporate with a fancy role on the paper without being satisfied. Because, you know, it's very, very crucial to be happy going at work or working from home in this new reality that we face. And of course, ideally, you might have both. Okay. Now, the second advice would be to adopt a test and learn and continuous test and learn approach that doesn't necessarily start by testing. It can easily start by learning from, from college, from a friend, from a mentor, from a certification. But what's important is to test afterwards if this fits with your reality, with your values. And of course, the other way around, that you start by testing, then you get all the learnings and you move on to the next chapter. You know, that's how you keep the whole wheel spinning. It's very, very important not to just be testing or just learning. It's important to do both. Now, advice to managers of today, I would say that I tend to agree more with people saying that we should treat our colleagues and our internal teams the same way or even better way compared to our customers. This is very crucial for the whole culture within a team. And being nice is probably the most important revolution that we can actively be part of in our lifetime. Thanks a lot for inviting me here today. If someone wants to reach out, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Vasilis Sandros, that's my name.
Hey, so this is Akshay again. I hope you enjoyed that. And now let's get back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
And welcome back, everyone. Through the power of radio, we have miraculously moved from Boston to another setting where I've actually got two people from the other side of the world, literally the other side of the world, on this half of the podcast. One of them is not has relocated, but I still like to think of it as from the other side of the world. But I'll introduce them in a moment. So we first have, starting from east to west, we've got Rob England, one half of an amazing duo, better known as Teal Unicorn. Rob is a organizational agility coach working in the APAC region. He's a prolific Twitter user. It's at Rob England, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, Rob_England.
Rob_England, thank you. And you can find a lot of his writings and musings either on LinkedIn or on the Teal Unicorn website, which is tealunicorn.com, I believe. And before he started Teal Unicorn, I just want to give a shout out that Rob produced some of the best thinking I've seen in the service management industry in the last 15 years. And I regularly point to a book that I've now lost and I've had to buy an electronic copy so I don't lose it again. And that is Standard Plus Case. I thought that was an amazing piece of writing. And I think if you're working in the service management industry, you definitely owe it to yourself to get a copy of that book and have a read through. There are excerpts on the basicsm.com website, if I remember correctly. So go check that out. It is really, really good stuff. Paired with Rob today is an experienced hand at these Axelos podcasts. You may remember her from the last episode where she came on to talk about photography, being a semi-professional photographer herself. And it's none other than Simone Jo Moore. Simone is based in is also based is also from the other side of the world, as I put it, but she's currently based out of France, and she works across Europe, helping companies with organizational change, agility, resilience. We had a really good conversation the other day about service empathy, for example. So if you get a chance to see Simone talk at a conference near you or a virtual event near you, I think you definitely owe it to yourself to make the time to listen to what she has to say. So both of you, thank you for joining us for this half of the podcast. Really appreciate you making the time for it. In the first half, our audience heard the interview with Raina. And what we're going to do in the second half is to discuss some of the things that stood out from that interview and talk about how we can see those aspects of creativity or of working in an IT or IT service management context. So I'll again start from east to west. And so, Rob, you're in the hot seat first. What was something that stood out from that interview?
Well, there were a few things. The first thing that I liked and noted was talking about enabling constraints, the idea that constraints are not always a negative thing, that by having to overcome the constraints of having minimal tools or having a specific show format to meet or whatever it might be, actually stimulates creativity rather than stifling it. And I think that's a principle that is well known in work, I guess. But we can make more of that, I think, in terms of agreeing the enabling constraints in any work that we do.
I suppose just to pick up on that thread a little bit, I know there's been a thread of discussion in the industry in the last, I'd say, I've seen it more in the last 10 years. Friction, if you will, from self-enabling teams who want to be able to pick the tools that they use and create their own set of constraints, if you will, versus enterprise architecture, where there are certain systems of record or which for certain reasons might be mandated across the organization, etc. So there's a little bit of a tug of war between them. So in your opinion, where is it appropriate to create the constraints or loosen those constraints in an IT organization? Should it be at the top or should it be at a sort of team level or a mix?
In the last year or so, I've been getting my head around polarity tensions and this idea that, you know, you can have unresolvable dilemmas and you do the yes and thinking. You just accept it and move on and take it as a given rather than trying to solve it. And I think this question is absolutely one of those that it depends, that the good consultants answer, that we both are correct, you know, and we just have to navigate a path through the middle of that. So I always say that we try and take the unreasonableness out of work with Agile, but we roll it up into a big sticky ball and we give it to the enterprise architects because they're the ones who are left with the unreasonable aspect that we demand reducing total cost of ownership and standardization, but we also demand empowerment and freedom. And that it's just a dilemma. It just has to be figured out on a case by case. So, yes, it's a great idea to mandate one repository for all code, quite often, but no, it's not a great idea to mandate continuous delivery pipeline tooling necessarily, depending on their mode of working and the actual technology that they're trying to shove down the pipe and so on. It might be quite different answers for different teams.
Fair enough. I agree. The consultant's answer, it depends, is I think the only thing you can say in this case. So moving. Westwards, let's head west to Simone. And Simone, thank you for joining us, as I said. What was something that stood out from the interview with Raina that you'd like to talk about?
What you mean besides stirring the pot? One of my favorite things to do. I really enjoyed Raina's interview. I thought it was really great. I like the way she calls herself a metaphysician of joy.
And I think that is really terrific. And I will pick up on what Rob was saying about constraints. It was one of the things that stood out for me. And it happens often in the kitchen all the time. It's like you go to the cupboard and you go, damn, I haven't got that ingredient. What am I going to do? And looking for potential alternatives or deciding that you'll end up making something else entirely. And that certainly can happen in our technical world, whether that be an issue around skills and capability or be the technology available to us at the time, that sort of thing. So I really like that. One of the things I talk about a lot is what I would call sandbox thinking. Now, a lot of people think of a sandbox as a, you know, your play space, which is exactly what it is. Yeah, but think about it in terms of if I said to you, build me a sandcastle, both of you right now have an image of a sandcastle in your head, and I can guarantee you it will not look the same. And that's the cool thing about it, because if I have a bucket and pail, great. I can see what kind of sandcastle I could potentially make from that. But there are other people that once they do that, they might start molding it with their hands. They'll add a bit of water. Oh, I found a shell and a stick. So they can make a flag and a castle door. And then other people will create something that you wouldn't have even imagined to have been called a sandcastle. Look at all the sand sculpting competitions that are abound. So basically, it comes back to, you know, are you doing things in new ways or are you doing new things? Because they all want the quicker, faster, cheaper, greener, et cetera. That's going to always be there. Great. So dump the sand in a bucket, turn it upside down. But doing you could also be doing the old things differently if you've got one of those constraints in place. And we want to know, can we push the boundaries? How flexible are those boundaries? Or are we going to break through a boundary? Or are we happy to have that structure there to hold us more stable? You know, it's a question we ask ourselves. And maybe we can do things we couldn't do before because guess what? Something just got added to my pantry or I got a new kitchen tool. Maybe we can do things we didn't even imagine we could do yet. You know, experimenting. I mean, you know, my husband's still breathing. So that's a, you know, when I think about all the different recipes during lockdown, I've gone mad on cooking and I am cooking all sorts of things that I've never attempted before as a result. But, you know, he's still breathing. So it must be working.
And long may he continue to breathe. I'll go next and then we'll come around for come back around to Rob for some other thoughts. I did make quite a few notes, and I just want to continue on the theme of constraints, I think, because we've all spoken about that once. Clearly, it's something that resonated with the three of us. But there was one thing that she said, which I certainly knew from my own experience. And she said something along the lines of free rein can be overwhelming. You know, when we have no constraints, it can be really overwhelming. And I know that, for you know, I made a jokey LinkedIn post or Facebook post or something last year where I was talking about my blog post creative process. You know, which sort of started off by, you know, step one, open Word. Step two, stare at the blinking cursor for 5 minutes. And then step three, check Facebook, then check Twitter, check LinkedIn, you know, go back to step two. And sometimes just being presented with that blank canvas, even though you know what the end goal is, figuring out where to start and then how to craft that journey can be overwhelming. You know, it's not exactly writer's block, but because of this, I eventually end up writing that blog post. But making that start sometimes can be overwhelming because you can move in any direction and you're almost sort of paralyzed in terms of which direction you can move in. And I see that, I've seen that not just in myself, but in colleagues I've worked with. For example, when you're asked to, I don't know, come up with a sketch out a new process or a procedure that the team can follow when dealing with a specific type of event or request or something like that. And they're asked to do it from scratch. You know, don't consider what the current tool set tells you. Don't consider what the current policy. If you had to design it as the way you want, you know, in an ideal world, how would you go about doing it? And I've seen some people almost paralyzed because they don't know where to start or how to even approach such a problem. I may have mentioned this on a previous podcast, but I'm going to make a really, really broad generalization because this is the way it was described to me. And I apologize for anyone I may offend with this generalization. One of my very first managers told me, actually, that you are likely to encounter two types of people in the workplace. There's the consultant and the developer. They might not be consulting, they might not be developing, but those are the two sort of archetypes that you're most likely going to encounter. The consultant archetype will work without much direction beyond the initial outcome statement. And they'll figure out a way to get to that outcome, but it might not be exactly what you asked for. The developer needs everything to be specified. They need a set of specifications or a set of stories or whatever it might be. And then they will work to that specification and they will produce exactly what you asked for. And, you know, the really good developers might go a little bit off base and say, actually, I thought this might be better than what you specified, et cetera. So again, I don't mean to offend with the generalization, but listening to Raina, that was something that popped in my mind, that old piece of advice that sometimes that some people can work in those conditions of complete freedom. And for other people, that's not a suitable way of working. And I think we can see that manifesting in our own workplaces in different ways.
I don't like it. Can you please just tell me what to do? It's a direct quote from someone at one of my clients.
Yeah, I get that a lot as well. So Rob, let's come to you. What's something else that stood out from that interview with Raina?
Oh well, I'll go to the other extreme from something sort of systemic and analytical like enabling constraints to the thing that she said about how creativity comes from an internal source within you regardless of the context, and that once you can contact and access that internal source, then shape-shifting, as she put it, becomes possible. You can channel that creativity in
multiple contexts. Thank it, Rob. You took my point.
No, was that your phone? That was this idea that there are things so far below the conscious, and I think through life you slowly get exposed to your subconscious and you slowly see it, catch it every now and then around a corner. You suddenly see your subconscious doing something. It's like you might learn some meditation and get to look down in there and see it moving, or you I nearly died of hypothermia once and some deep subconscious part of me actually took control and got me to safety when my conscious brain had literally ceased, my cerebral cortex had just ceased to function from the cold, and that something, and I was watching this third party. I understand where sort of religious visions come from, because if I hadn't been a devout atheist, I would have seen a supernatural element to this inner me just taking control and moving me to safety. So through life, you slowly get to see this inner self, subconscious at work, and you start to realize it's there and become more and more aware of it. And I think with creativity, it's as you grow that connection, you start to realize more where your creativity is coming from. Does that make sense? And so you get more in touch with it.
Okay, completely. I think I may have mentioned it on the previous episode where we were talking about photography. Maybe Simone can remind me if I said this or not. But I feel like my creativity has improved or even flowed in different directions once I picked up my dad's old SLR camera, about 14 years ago, I think it was. And I just started fooling around with it. And then I just became interested in photography. And I now, maybe this is too grandiose a statement, but I like to think of myself as a much more visually creative person. I prefer to communicate using imagery rather than words. I prefer to communicate using storytelling, speech, rather than, you know, writing a white paper. Or a blog post or something like that. So I found my creativity or my creative juices are now flowing in a different direction. Possibly it's the scope of things I can do creatively have expanded. I mean, I don't know whether I should just give up trying to learn the guitar because, you know, it's been 20 years that I've been trying to master the blasted C chord and I just cannot get it for the life of me. So, you know, who knows, maybe rewinding 20 years and maybe the creativity would have flowed in that direction if I'd taken a different decision.
Perhaps another way to put it, I think, too, is that, as I say, as you become more aware of your inner self, you triangulate back so that your musical talent, such as it is, and your visual creativity and your work creativity, you start to triangulate back so that you can see the point that they're all coming from. And that point is somewhere deep, deep inside you. But the more you have different creative outlets, you can sort of triangulate back from each of them to figure out where that deep inner source of that is coming from.
Has this been something that you've also seen in the workplace? But, and this is an open question to both of you. Do you see a lot of sort of leaders or developers or designers tapping into a non-technical creative aspect of themselves and bringing that to their work?
Yeah, I think they do, because especially around the problem solving side of stuff, you need creativity when, you know, you're problem solving. And regardless of what the problem is, small, large, intricate, you know, it doesn't matter. It's one of those things that you tap into the possibility. And that's why I like to call it the art of the possible, because it doesn't mean that you will have an answer. I like what you said earlier, Rob, about that. You know, sometimes you just got to let something go for a while. And I think that's part of it. Sometimes we throw ourselves into something, it gets crazy because you just, you know, constantly bashing your head against a brick wall, and that's when you got to walk away. I think one of the key things around using creativity in the workplace, I mean, I love what you said about having super empathic sense. And, you know, that's something I've definitely had from a child. And there's a huge learning curve to finally understanding that things like emotional intelligence and, you know, empathy is actually a core base for everything else, because you have to see the connections, and it takes empathy of different levels, but to see those connections, you know, imagining it on the other side. And that learning curve is huge to finally understand that it's not a triumph of heart over head. It's actually the unique intersection of both of those things that helps you come to various solutions and realizations of what is possible. And that, to me, is very much the heart of when I talk about framework mixology. You know, one of the things Raina said was, you know, you take something, you know, you expand it and you twist it up a little. And that, to me, is, you know, creating the right flavor from all the frameworks that we have. So I see it where we've got a little bit of, you know, idle going on, a bit of DevOps, a bit of Agile. And the point is they're actually not mutually exclusive. You know, there are ingredients within all of those that can come together and create the dish that's right for you. And that's what we're starting to see evolve on a natural level in some cases now, because people say, well, okay, well, that fits here and that fits there. And they start to mold and shape it into the solution that they need. So I think, you know, realizing heart over head is not the way to go. It's not one or the other. It's those two coming together and mixing things up and giving it that little twist that will help us evolve. It's not a fusion. It's an evolving into something else.
I think there's another element to that point, which is sometimes the unlikeliest of combinations will react to produce something that's truly marvelous, whether that's in the workplace or, you know, where you have the odd couple, if anyone remembers that show, that you have the odd couple that somehow are just so disparate as characters. But when you put them together, they are actually achieving some tremendous results.
Dr. Vu and Rob England.
You said it, not me.
Spicing up life.
I mean, to extend the cooking example, I remember the first time I saw a, I forget which YouTube channel, I follow a lot of cooking YouTube channels, but I remember seeing somebody make a grilled cheese sandwich by first putting mayonnaise on the side of the bread and then putting that mayonnaise side down on the pan. I was like, you're cooking mayonnaise. How does that make any sense? And then I started to read into it and the science of the reactions that are happening. And that's when I sort of realized that, you know, sometimes you can throw together unlikely ingredients, which will not mix, but they'll actually react together and transform into something, something beautiful.
You know, another really good example of that is Standard Plus Case.
Yeah.
There you go, Rob.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But that, you've just described the art of mixology. I mean, this is the whole reason for you've got to know, I guess, what some of those ingredients will do. What are the tastes? What are the flavors of those things? How does this particular flavor go with that flavor? When you start mixing up these combinations, even within the frameworks themselves, when you start mixing up these combinations, there's a unique depth or a feeling or a taste that, you know, the client is going to get out of this, or the employee will experience as a result of that. You know, I think we need to create more mixologists within our teams.
Absolutely. I'll give you one more example, and then I'll give a last point in this round robin before we close off the call. I'm presenting a session in a couple of weeks with a gentleman from the Co-op, which, for those of you who are from other parts of the world, the Co-op is a conglomerate of businesses. They do grocery stores, they do banks, insurance, funeral care. So it's a real disparate set of portfolio of businesses. But he works in the digital products team, and he's a service manager there. And, you know, the whole talk is about how you could take ITIL, which a lot of his development teams used to see as the slow bureaucratic process heavy framework. But he took the guiding principles that we talk about in ITIL 4, and he applied it to how the different teams would work together, and the chemistry of, you know, the guiding principles, the tools they use, the agile ways of working, et cetera, has now produced something that's really, really good and meets the needs of the organization and possibly even exceeds the needs of the organization. So definitely framework mixology is a very, very powerful concept if you can guide it and coach it properly. I'll make one last point that I took away from Raina's call. I think she said it towards the very end of the interview. And she mentioned that feedback is a slippery slope, especially when you've got a lot of voices and a lot of perspectives. And it's always a difficult decision about whose opinion should you listen to the most. You know, I can certainly attest to that through the course of, for example, developing ITIL 4. You know, whose feedback do you listen to? Is it the ATOs, the end users, the DevOps evangelists, the Agilistas, the infrastructure engineers? Whose perspective should you be listening to? And, you know, there is no easy answer. In a way, it's all of them. But you've also got to be able to listen to your internal stakeholders. You know, what does the product roadmap say? In which direction you want to take that roadmap? And you've got to find a way of balancing these perspectives. Oftentimes, we are working in highly complex environments where we're trying to satisfy the needs of multiple stakeholders. And I think part of maturing as a product company or a services company, for that matter, is understanding that you will never please everyone. And you've got to, in a way, build a little bit of that thick skin so that you can take their feedback constructively. You can assess it for what it is and see if there's a way in which you can meet the needs of that feedback or respond to that feedback. But in many cases, you've just got to be able to, you've got to have the emotional maturity as a team to be able to say, we can't do anything about this. That's not the direction in which we want to move. Whether that's a digital product or a platform team running a private cloud or managing a cloud provider, whether that's, you know, us here at Axelos trying to shape some of the guidance that we're writing, there are always going to be multiple voices. And it is a difficult decision. Have you guys come across that sort of tension within the teams that you've worked with? And do you have any tips for our listeners about how to navigate these treacherous waters, if you will?
Again, I've this polarity tensions idea has been very influential on me to what you're saying, that the yes and mentality. It's like, well, this is irreconcilable, therefore it becomes a constraint of the environment. It becomes a, rather than a problem to be solved, it just becomes an attribute of the environment that we accept and we work with and we move on. It is what it is, that classical saying. So I liked your term, you know, the emotional maturity to be able to just deal with it, accept it, and understand that it's not going to be appeased or resolved.
And I think the other aspect of working in a complex environment is whatever, no matter what you put out, there will be some unforeseen consequences. There will be unanticipated consequences or reactions from the rest of that ecosystem. So in a way, you can't, and you can never engineer that perfect solution, because there will always be something that you never considered. So in some ways, it's better to, of course, you've got to consider every piece of feedback that comes your way and decide what you want to do with it. But you've also, I think, to flip that on its head, you need to have rapid feedback mechanisms so that you can understand what changes are taking place, where they're taking place, and what the sort of wider effect of those changes might be. So you've got to be constantly scanning your ecosystem, your product ecosystem, your service ecosystem, to be able to understand what changes are taking place. Your product might be moving into territories that you had not foreseen, and you've got to be able to figure out how to deal with that.
I think one of the key things that Raina said that comes up for me when on this particular topic is being completely you, because none of it happens in a vacuum. And I liked the way she was talking about amping up what you have in your inside personality and dropping away those external layers. In other words, being more transparent, being more authentic. Now, that does take a level of resilience. It does take some of the emotional maturity, but there is a skill set here too to deal with feedback and the way that we, remembering that we're responding to that feedback. So we have control of our response, our own response to that. So I think that there's a really key thing here when she said as well that you can't outsource your expertise to everybody. Because it's your experience, it's your knowledge, your competencies. But what we can do is expand those, become more, you know, more emotional agility that we have in working with the different thoughts and feelings and priorities of those providing the feedback. And it becomes, again, it's contextual. You can't take one situation and say, well, that's the solution, or that's how I'll respond in that particular, you know, for that. And I'll use exactly the same response to someone else. And I can have the same question given to me by two team members, but because of the nature, or if I guess the, the modifying agents or factors involved in that, in their situation when they asked it, I don't necessarily have the same decision or response to that. So I think it does come back to our experience and our capability to formulate and understand the context in which that sits, and then that emotional agility to deal with the relationship, because every part of that feedback is actually based on either how I relate to that person or how they relate to me or to that product or that service. So we have to consider, you know, the relevancy of the relationships and the context in which that's coming at it.
That's a really good point. And on that revelation, let's wrap up this call. My sincere thanks to Simone and Rob for making the time to come on and discuss the points that stood out from Raina's interview. Simone can be found at simonejoemore.com, and that's more as an MOORE, not MORE. And Joe is just JO. So simonejoemore.com. And on Twitter, she's also at simonejoemore. And Rob is Mr. Teal Unicorn, perhaps. Tealunicorn.com, or on Twitter, he can be found at Rob_England. Both of them are very active on LinkedIn as well, so you can find them there. If you have any thoughts or feedback that you'd like to share about what you've just heard, please do email in at ask@axelos.com. I've had a lot of fun interviewing not only Raina, but also talking about the interview itself with Rob and Simone. And I hope you can join me for the next episode, where we would be talking about stand-up comedy. So until then, until next time, stay safe and please wash your hands.
Presented by Axelos.